Thank you very much, Professor Nutter. I'm to speak about Czechoslovakia, which is a perhaps dangerous topic these days. Things change so rapidly in Czechoslovakia that one never knows what's right. I was speaking to a Yugoslav the other day, and I was worried that I might be there might be some inaccuracies in my talk this afternoon, and he said, don't worry about it. He says, nobody knows what's going on, not even the people who are there. Well, let me begin with the observation that economic reform in East Europe is not new. Apart from the Soviet Union, the reforms began with Yugoslavia, but they also took place in the other countries of the Eastern Bloc in the decade of the 50s. But since 1963, a more general reform movement has been underway. While there are many causes, other and deeper causes underlying this movement, which help to explain the great diversity of the reforms, I think it's clear that the proximate cause was an intensified realization of the shortcomings of the central command system. These defects were brought out by various economic problems which surfaced in Eastern Europe in the early part of this decade, most particularly by the obvious stagnation of growth in industrial output and the standard of living. However, despite the fact that economic reforms were underway in most of the East European countries during this period, that is, since 1962, say, there were some fundamental differences among them. The reforms can be divided into two classes. In countries such as Poland, East Germany, and the Soviet Union, the reforms were intended, on the whole, merely to improve the efficiency of the existing central command system. Some decentralization of decision was permitted, as in permitting selected enterprises in the Soviet Union to make individual agreements with material suppliers. Some prices were to be freed, but the main purpose of this reform was to provide better information for the center in its planning decisions. In these countries, there was never any serious questioning of the role of the center or of the central command system of planning. On the other hand, in Czechoslovakia and Hungary, the economic reforms were fundamentally different. The nature of the planning process itself was to be changed. In these countries, the reforms had as their rough pattern the Yugoslav system and perhaps the French. The role of the center under the command system is that of centrally planning detailed outputs of enterprises and attempting to achieve these outputs by means of direct orders to the enterprises. This role in Czechoslovakia and Hungary was to change to one in which the center influenced the pattern of investment, general pattern of investment, and provided information in the form of predictions of economic activity for the use of enterprises in making their output decisions. Whether this new role of the center can be regarded as economically sensible or desirable is really immaterial to this, to the argument. The point is that the Czech and Hungarian economic reforms involve more fundamental changes than elsewhere. In reforms such as these, it is essential that the changes be thorough enough to prevent reaction from within the system. There are many reasons why half-hearted reforms are likely to fail. It is very important, in the first place, that the economic bureaucracy be thoroughly changed, if not actually destroyed. The most obvious reason for this is simply that the bureaucrats have a strong vested interest in maintaining the system. After all, their jobs depend on it, at least in large measure. If they can argue that the reforms are unpopular, recommendations to return to the old system are clearly more persuasive. For example, the freeing of consumer prices leads to manifestation of previously suppressed inflation, which would be expected in many East European countries. People who place a low value on time would react negatively to reform. The problems go much beyond this, however. The very existence of the control links from the center to the enterprises, which of course are basic to central command planning, implies that the bureaucrats are in position to counter from the center any changes occurring at the periphery which appear damaging to their own position. It is not even necessary to posit deliberate sabotage of the reforms. Economic reform which is not thorough at the enterprise level will probably involve some undesirable effects which the center will try to offset. Finally, as long as the links from the center to the enterprise exist, it is obviously all too easy to reinstitute central command planning when the bureaucrats find it convenient to do so. If the machinery exists, the temptation to use it is powerful. This remains a fact regardless of who the bureaucrats are, and hence largely despite any purges of bureaucracy which might take place. Well, the need for structural reform does not end with the economic bureaucracy and really thorough reform. as is commonly known in East Europe as elsewhere, party interests and the interests of the people have historically had little in common. In those reforms whose purpose is improving the efficiency of the central command system, there is an implication that party interests in a really narrow sense are still paramount. On the other hand, if the purpose of the reform is to change the nature of the system, there is some implication that the role of the party is to change also. Perhaps the most important distinguishing feature of the Czech reforms was the turn they took to pluralism. While the party in name remained in a commanding position, its own nature had changed. If the position of the party is to change, then structural changes there are required also. It is well known that the structure of the economic bureaucracy in East European countries is closely paralleled by that of the party. At every level of the economic organization, the bureaucrat has as his counterpart some party apparatchik. This, of course, is one of the major means of control by the party, a sort of built-in police force to ensure that orders from the center are carried out. Again, if this structure is not changed, or if, at the very least, the apparatchiks associated with the central command system are not replaced, the reforms are once more doomed, this time at the hands of the party. Consequently, political reform may be required for the survival of economic reform as well. As long as the party remains the dominant political force, and as long as it is a closed body, reaction against economic reform is likely. Whenever reforms in economic life produce results which are counter to the interests of the party, its political dominance will be used to destroy the reforms. Reversion to a central command system is almost certain, since that system is the least costly means to the party of maintaining party interests above any others. Thus, durable economic reforms may require decentralization of political power as well as economic decision making. The logical consequences of this conclusion are sweeping, I think, and are an important reason why lasting reform depends partly on fortuitous circumstances and the course of development of the reform. Well, with those few remarks, with which you may agree or disagree, I would now like to consider briefly the Czech reforms, indicating why the economic reforms themselves were probably not the cause of the Soviet invasion. This is a view which is in opposition to that held by some people. In particular, just the other day, Sulzberger had a column in which he said the opposite. Well, after some consideration of these reforms, I want to just briefly mention the political reforms and try to show why there is an element of chance in a meaningful reform. Well, it's well known that the Czech economic reforms were the most rapid in all of East Europe. Foremost in the reforms, and to a large extent dictating the other elements of them, was the basic change in vision for the plan. It is true that there was still to be planning, but it was to be entirely different from the central command system of planning. In particular, annual plans were simply abolished. For 1967-68, there was, in fact, no central plan. The planning function was to become one of long-range forecasting, formation of broad investment policy, and promotion of economic stability and growth. Sounds like some other places we could think of. Enterprises were to make their own output decisions based on the prices existing in the markets for intermediate and final goods, using value added as the basic decision criteria. It is true that the price reform left much to be desired, especially in the disappointing degree of freeing of prices which actually took place. This meant that the signals received by enterprises on the markets were still distorted as compared to a truly free price system. However, there were no physical output targets for firms, which is the hallmark of the central command system. No sets of detailed orders regarding the levels of input and output, the assortment of goods produced, and so forth, were issued to firms last year. The Czech reformers envisioned a gradual movement to market-determined prices, free from interference by the center. It's indicative of the difficulties of reform, I think, that the rate at which prices were actually freed fell really far short of even the gradual transition desired by the reformers. In the reforms of 1966-67, prices were categorized as free, limited, or fixed, depending upon various characteristics of the commodities involved. For example, raw materials prices were considered of key importance to the economy, which led by the perverse logic of the Marxist mind to placing their prices in the fixed category. On the other hand, prices of most consumer goods were to be placed in the free category. It's not entirely clear what prices were to be in the limited classification. In that classification, there was to be some range within which prices would be free to move, sort of like a pegged exchange rate, I guess. The result of all this and of internal compromising was that at the beginning of this year, only about 15% of all prices were free. Whatever the reasons for this disappointing outcome, it's clear that the price reform was less radical than what was anticipated. Going beyond the price reform, another facet was the change in investment policy. Under a command system, all investment decisions of any significance are made at the center. Enterprises may submit requests for investment funds in the course of constructing the annual plan, but they have only the most limited means of making investments on their own initiative. For example, a firm could make some barter deals with other enterprises with which it had contacts in order to obtain some piece of equipment. Indeed, this system, which the so-called system of pushers, is of considerable importance to the operation of any command system. However, any reasonably large investment clearly could not be handled in this way. Investment funds were centrally allocated in the plan for specific projects. Indeed, if there was any rationale for a command system as a tool for forced industrialization, I think this type of investment control is one of the most important parts of it. When the check reforms, this too was to change. Enterprises were to make the bulk of investment decisions themselves, obtaining funds by borrowing at the state bank. Furthermore, the interest rate was to be a functional capital rationing device, as opposed to being merely a nominal charge levied in the hope of preventing sheer waste of capital, which is closer to its role than, for example, the Soviet Union. Of course, this system still left the center with considerable opportunities for control of investment through its control of the state bank. The center also was to retain some investment decisions for itself, was to set general policy for investment, and to set out criteria for investment, presumably to be enforced once again through the bank. Retention of control of prices was obviously another lever of control over investment. It's obvious that a capital market in the Western sense was not envisioned. However, the reform was by no means minor and was consistent with the general policy of decentralization. A final facet of the reforms worth mentioning was the policy toward material supply. The central allocation of materials is a key feature of the command system, since it is through this control that the center can most definitely ensure that output levels and composition comply with its desires. Also, central control of materials is one of the cornerstones of political control in a command system. Subversive opinion is less likely to be circulated, for example, if the center directly allocates paper, ink, power, and so forth. In the check reforms, central allocation of material supply was ended. Last year, for the first time since the institution of Stalinist planning in 1948, firms were to make their own supply contracts independent of the center. Even the Hungarian reforms did not go this far in knocking down the props of the command system. But in summary, the Czech economic reforms were an important and significant break with the central command system of planning. Yet, I maintain that it was not these reforms that led to the Soviet invasion, at least not directly. There was, in particular, never any question about remaining socialist, no possibility mentioned anywhere, that I know of anyhow, of turning to the capitalist model. The action program of the Czech Communist Party is very specific on this point, and I'll just give a couple of quotations to try to illustrate that. And I'm quoting now from that action program. "The socialist order has sunk its roots deeply and firmly into our land. Our society, in which the means of production are mainly in the hands of the socialist state or of workers' cooperatives, has got rid of capitalist exploitation and the social wrongs connected with it." Second quotation, "We are not changing our fundamental orientation. In the spirit of our traditions and former decisions, we want to develop in this country an advanced socialist society." End quote. These quotations exemplify the general tenor of the action program and of the policy orientation of the party. Czechoslovakia was to remain socialist. It seems clear to me, anyhow, that this was not just a smokescreen of words intended to pacify the Soviet Union. Anybody, I think, who reads the statements of the leaders or talks with Czech economists, for example, can only believe that they really meant it. In particular, there is almost nothing in the way of modifying ownership of the means of production, a position which is common throughout Eastern Europe, including Yugoslavia. There are indications that some relaxation in the direction of individual enterprises, as in Yugoslavia, were contemplated, especially in agriculture and the service industries. But this is the exception. The general policy was and is that the means of production remain the property of the state. This, I think, is a point which convergence fans might keep in mind, that as far as anyone can tell, there's no budging from this position. There are serious problems, of course, involved in this dogmatic position, both economic and political. From the economic point of view, allocative efficiency is seriously impaired, if not actually made impossible, if firms cannot trade freely in the factors of production. And I think it hardly needs to be argued to this audience that the independence of life that private property and the means of production brings is essential to political liberty. From this standpoint, one can legitimately ask whether even the Czech reforms were proceeding very far along the road back. Furthermore, for this very reason, the probability of eventual internal reaction and reversion to a powerful authoritarian state was increased. In view of the fact that this question is, as I mentioned, the bedrock point of ideology in the communist states, from which none has so far budged, a pessimistic view of the reform movement in general is forced on the observer. In any event, on the fundamental ideological questions, the economic reforms themselves did not deviate so far from the communist line as to cause the Soviet Union to incur the costs in their relations with communist parties elsewhere, which the invasion entailed. There seems small room to doubt, I think, that it was the political changes that were taking place that proved too much for the Soviet Union. Economic decentralization is sometimes seen as the opening for political reform, and is advocated as much for that reason as any other. However, in the Czech case, the reverse seems to be nearer the truth. The economic reforms were only a part of a more fundamental and general reform of the Czech society. The Czech political reforms proceeded from the basic premise that the society should break with the authoritarian system of the Stalinist type and deliberately move to a pluralistic, a pluralistic society. Once that step is taken, a set of changes is set in motion, the precise content and timing of which cannot be predicted. In Czechoslovakia, a number of immediate reforms were involved, and I can only mention a few of them here. First, the National Front was revived as a vehicle for decentralization of political authority. It was not intended that the National Front should provide opposition to the Communist Party. There was no question of the predominance of the party in the leadership of the nation. Actually, the party could feel very confident in this. Its membership was 1.7 million, or about 30% of the adult population in Czechoslovakia. None of the other organizations included in the front even began to approach such a number. Second, apparently meaningful reform of the electoral process was instituted. Under the reform measure, candidates could be nominated by non-party organizations, and the nonsensical mock elections of earlier days were to be eliminated. In the first local party elections after the reform, former office holders in the Communist Party, in quotes, elected under the old system, were soundly repudiated. In fact, the timing of the Soviet invasion, about 3 weeks prior to the 14th Party Congress, at which these newly elected representatives would choose a new central committee, was no doubt strongly influenced by this outcome. Third, freedom of association was revived and explicitly encouraged in the action program. Previously, all organizations were tightly controlled by the party. The reforms provided for the for their free formation. Again, this was not viewed by the party as a germination of opposition to it. Whether this would have occurred in time is, of course, debatable. A fourth reform had to do with the relations of the party to the economic bureaucracy. Here, the links between the party and the economic mechanism were broken. The party was no longer to interfere in the management of enterprises or in the state affairs of the economic ministries. The question that immediately arises is that of how the party was enticed into giving up these controls. The answer to this is not clear, but it's probably tied up closely with the relatively large membership of the party in Czechoslovakia. Given the commanding position of the party in all East European countries, it is clear that any reform must at least meet with its approval, short of actual revolution. In Yugoslavia, economic reform was, from the early days, in the interest of the party, in its effort to construct its so-called new way for socialist countries, deviating from the Soviet Union. In that case, naturally, the party itself originated the reforms. This is also true in Czechoslovakia, with the important difference that party discipline was relatively weak because of the broad membership base. The reforms were still in the interests of the party, but I think one can only reach the conclusion that the interests of the party had somehow changed. Other important political reforms took place: the abolition of the 8th Department of the party, the abolition of cadre ceilings in the bureaucracy, and reorganization of the Ministry of the Interior being among them. But I think further detailing is unnecessary. The real problem in this reform arises with the timing and internal logic of them. Reforms of this type, the political type that were going on in Czechoslovakia, cannot very well be planned because they depend on the actions of so many people. Not only are the types of reforms unpredictable, but also their timing. Once the position is taken that the basic policy is to promote a pluralistic society, a Pandora's box is opened, and the precise course that will be taken cannot be foreordained. This, after all, I think, is the very nature of pluralistic society. While not chaotic, it is open to change from all quarters. Thus, in Czechoslovakia, the planned election reforms, as well as other matters such as the active desire to arouse criticism of the bureaucracy, led eventually to the elimination of censorship, as everyone knows. With no censorship, Czechoslovakia began to take on the appearance of an open society, again, as everyone knows. Freedom of association and speech, which had been for so long suppressed, burst forth with energy seldom seen even in the West. And it was probably this, I think, as much as anything, that the Soviets felt they could not stand. The question could be raised, what could have been done to prevent the invasion? Perhaps a lot of things, but I'll just mention one line that people sometimes take. It's possible to argue that had the general course of political reform been less rapid, if perhaps censorship had not been lifted so soon, then the invasion would not have occurred. If it had not, then the reforms would have taken solid root. There are, of course, I think, two problems, at least, with that argument. The first is that reduction in the rate of political reform might have led to general defeat of the reforms because of internal reaction, for reasons that I've just mentioned. Furthermore, the reforms in that case would have been different reforms, and the roots sent out anchors for a less open society. Second, as mentioned a moment ago, the commitment to pluralism meant that the course of events could no longer be determined from the standpoint of optimal strategy. Too many people were free, and the logic of the commitment demanded that they be so to permit this. In another situation, and perhaps the Hungarian is that situation, the working out of reform would not be so rapid. Surely, I think, in a thing as complicated as a modern society, surely the sequence and timing of the reforms would be different. But this is the point, I think, at least the point of what I've been trying to say. Not only is the road back a delicate one, balanced between internal reaction and Soviet intervention, but there are also strong elements just of sheer luck involved. Perhaps this is what we should expect in a meaningful reform, and perhaps it's what we must live with. Thank you.